You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
The sculptor Imogen Stewart and the poet Michael Cody died within a day of each other on the 24th and 25th of March this year. Each is remembered with a programme from the RTE archive in this evening's Lyric Feature. We begin with John Quinn's 2001 programme, Three Men Standing at the Met, where we find the writer Michael Cody listening to a broadcast of Verdi's La Forza del Destino from the Metropolitan Opera in New York in his home in Carrickonshire, County Waterford, and reflecting all the while on a November night in 1927 when his father and two uncles attended the same opera at the New York Met. This is Three Men Standing at the Met.
Standing in sunshine by Highway 84, I'm photographing a factory which is no longer there. Looking for my father by an assembly line which has halted and vanished into air. Catching the sepia ghost of a young tubercular Irishman who's left a rooming house at 6 a.m. in a winter time during the Depression. When my mother is still a girl, playing precocious violin, a miraculous medal under her blouse, in Protestant oratorios in Waterford. A pallid face in the crowd in a dark winter time. He's coughing in the cold, assembling typewriters in Hartford, Connecticut, waiting for blood on his pillow to send him home, where he'll meet her one ordinary night with the band playing Solitude in the Forester's Hall. City, Friday, November 4th, 1927. That was then, and this is now. Or maybe vice versa. Now is Saturday, March 16th, 1996, and I'm tuning to a live broadcast of Verdi's La Forza del Destino from the Metropolitan Opera House. The music soars out of New York City to a satellite in space, overleaps an ocean, finds my study in a small town in an Irish river valley, animates the air between my bookshelves, earthing through my Uncle Peter's battered old trombone which hangs in the corner. All in a microsecond of transmission time from there to here. What has this to do with poetry? With some cosmic harmony of hearts, with the music of what happens. There are conspiring shades about me, standing again, listening to La Forza del Destino as they did on that November evening at the Old Met in 1927. I have spread before me as I listen the printed program which my future father sent back to impress his own father in Ireland.
La Forza del Destino, The Force of Destiny, opera in four acts, eight scenes, in Italian. Music by Giuseppe Verdi, Marquess of Calatava, Louis D'Angelo, Donna Leonora, Rosa Poncel, Don Carlos of Vargas, Mario Basiola, Don Alvaro, Giovanni Martinelli, Preziosila, Ina Borskaya, The Abbot, Ezio Pinza, Conductor Vincenzo Bellezza. Positively no encores allowed.
His written words upon the page which shows the seating plan.
Well, this is where we stood.
His X which marks the place.
It's a passageway leading to the orchestra seats, and it costs $3 to stand there.
My future father, George. His brothers, Jimmy and Peter. Three ragged-arsed young immigrants, their futures yet unscored in an America careering towards the crash of 29. The great calamity yawning just ahead like an apocalyptic Niagara. Its coming thunder still unheard above the roar of the 20s. There they stand, these brothers, under the boxes of the Vanderbilts, the Astors, the Harrimans, the Juilliards and J.P. Morgan, in a high temple of art and wealth and privilege.
They pay $66 a night for one box, and some of them buy them for the whole season for a few thousand dollars.
In a frantic metropolis of B-movie speakeasies, in a country soon to be flayed by a blizzard of collapsing stocks and bonds.
Ladies will kindly remove their hats during the performance. Reserved carriages may use the 39th Street, 40th Street, and Broadway entrances on arrival. The buffet is located on the grand tier floor. Red lights indicate exits. Fire notice. Look around now and choose the exit nearest to your seat. In case of fire, walk, not run, to that exit. Do not try to beat your neighbor to the street. John J. Dorman, Fire Commissioner.
In another part of the city on that November evening, wasn't the young Duke Ellington raising a storm at the Cotton Club? Those three young Irishmen know nothing yet of that nativity, that urgently American pulse and its mythologies. They're listening to Rosa Poncel, to Ezio Pinza, to Giovanni Martinelli, to sounds they've never heard, words they don't need to understand. The plot is outlandish, but the occasion magnificent. The music beats over them in passionate waves, as over me now, telling of relentless destiny, encounter, love and death, retribution and redemption. By day, they casually work as house painters, sign writers, elevator operators. Sometimes on cold nights, my father goes to the New York Public Library and transcribes poems of Yeats into a blank diary which, miraculously, will not be lost in time. Sometimes the three brothers skip work and spend a summer's day in Coney Island, touring the sideshows, gaping at the freaks, chasing the girls. Jimmy, the eldest and the first to emigrate at the age of 20 in 1920, will never see Ireland again. He'll marry a girl named Leah Grimshaw in Long Island, of a family disapproving of Catholics, and Irish Catholics particularly, though he'll never again darken a church door once he's escaped the bitterly remembered clerics of his youth. He'll make his passion for grand opera his religion, scratching a living as a sign writer in West Hampton, accumulating a record collection of great voices, drinking most nights at the patio. He'll become outwardly assimilated,
but never content, watching as year by year the New York rich appropriate the foreshore, hardening into a bitter old age, in the end as unforgiving of his Long Island village as of the town he came from. Over the years, letters from the homeland bring him word of clay on coffins. Father and mother, sisters, a brother. Towards the end, he'll write for photographs. The old bridge, Cook Lane, the Weir and Carrickbeg. 2 years before he dies, he'll almost make a visit back after 50 years. He'll get as far as JFK and then turn back, sending his American wife Leah instead. By the time I get to Long Island, he will be 10 years dead. I'll stand with Leah over the parched grass under which his ashes lie. Later, his daughter will come to Ireland, find the green river valley, the town, the house where her father's story began. She'll tell how he first brought her up to New York and the Met when she was 11. How he could never fathom her love of jazz. How he never spoke of Ireland. Had he buried and sealed it in some dumb hole he dug inside himself? This waits to happen as the curtain rises at the Met in November 1927. Peter, beside him, will weather the depression for a while, then come back to Ireland to marry Kathy Healy, his hometown sweetheart, the best-looking girl in Carrick, before some rival snatches her, and in spite of the unbending disapproval of his mother, a hard woman of the Victorian shopkeeper class who was also a secret drinker. Peter will rejoin the town's brass band under his father's baton and play the trombone which later I will play myself, the one which now hangs on my wall and sympathetically vibrates to Verdi. Later, Peter will switch to trumpet in dance bands, becoming a noted crooner in pub and ballroom. Old sidemen still remember the passion he put into his best song. Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time.
Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime.
When his teeth start to go, Peter will lay aside the trumpet and later take up alto sax, hitting the bottle hard until he dries out in his 40s, only to keel over on stage at 53, just as he counts the band, my mother on piano, into La Compersita in the Ormond Hall on St. Stephen's Night in 1958. The dancers sent home in shock, their money handed back as they exit. Buried in his musician's dress suit, he couldn't stand brown burial habits, not to mention churches, hospitals or funerals. Kathy, who bore him 9 children, will live to be a handsome 87, with stories of his binges, the trumpet or the dress suit in the pawn shop, the throwing of crockery, all told with laughter in the end. The third brother standing there will be my father, George. He's 21. After he returns to Ireland, he'll always wear his hat like George Raft and in drink say things like, "No dice, brother." He stands utterly entranced by Rosa Ponsell. A year before he dies in 1973, he'll write to her through the American Embassy, reminding her of how she sang Leonora in La Forza del Destino at the Met in 1927, his first year in America. The daughter of an Italian immigrant and originally a child singer in vaudeville, she'd made her spectacular metropolitan debut in 1918 as Caruso's choice in La Forza del Destino. Her handsome stage figure and golden voice were a sensation, with a seamless sound from rich low contralto to an effortless top C and electrifying trills. In 1937, the Met's in-house politics denied her a part she coveted. She had a nervous breakdown and packed it in for good. Her secretary will reply from Villa Pace in Baltimore in 1972, when she's 75, and a year before my father will come home from the pub one night to face his final coronary, just after he'd sung, "There's a long, long trail a-winding into the land of my dreams."
My dear Mr. Cody, Miss Ponsell is recovering from a severe illness and has asked me to thank you for your touching letter. Your devotion to opera struck a responsive chord, especially remembering those unpleasant times during the Depression. Miss Ponsell has asked me to send you her very best wishes and to file your letter with her very special ones. She regrets that this letter will not carry her signature due to her illness.
But that's still far upstream on that November evening at the Met. When the crash comes, my future father will stand in bread lines until he finds a job assembling typewriters in the Underwood factory in Hartford. Dark mornings from a rooming house, long lines of bent heads through 12-hour working days, the ceaseless prowl of elevated supervisors' cradles moving above the production line. Outside the gates, turned-up collars and beaten faces waiting for vacancies. One night, he'll cough awake to blood on his pillow. That dark seed he had carried in his lungs from Ireland. That intimate acquaintance which will take his father and young sisters. In the tangle of chance and choice, every effect in turn becomes a cause. When I'm a boy, he'll remember all this by the fireside, in his cups. The Hartford doctor's advice.
Get back to Ireland, young man.
The great storm on the passage home. His recovery under his mother's care. The dance he went to one night in the Forester's Hall. The girl from Waterford playing the piano. Duke Ellington's solitude as they danced together. and my own genesis by circumstantial indirection out of blood on a pillow in Hartford, a place in which I'll find myself by chance in 1982, touring on an open Greyhound ticket when he's 9 years dead. Remembering, I'll try to find the Underwood factory. Long gone, of course, with Highway 84 inexorably rolling through its vanished assembly lines, its distant tramp of factory hands, its muted tyranny of time and hooters and long-dead overseers. I stand on the highway's margin, a tourist in sunshine pointing a camera at a factory which is no longer there. A poem comes out of this, assembling the parts. As the pen finds it on the page, there's a jolt of recognition, the kind that's obvious once seen. Within that mundane timetable word, destination, the hooded arrest, the dark drum roll of destiny. 50 years on, he's 9 Septembers dead, and a tourist in sunshine by Highway 84 is photographing a factory which is no longer there, assembling the parts of the mundane mystery, the common enigma of journeys and unscheduled destinations, the lost intersections of person and place and time, uniquely fathering every man out of the random dark. In the long chain of consequence, there are no absolute beginnings, no absolutely final endings. All things connect in time. Before she dies in 1994, an old nun in Carrick will invite me to the convent, where she must vacate her music room and dispose of her treasures. She entered in 1926, the year my father went to America. Now, before she moves to a rest home after her stroke, she must offload her books, her sheet music, her bound Mozart sonatas, her old records. From the stack, she hands me, all unknowing, an old 78. Rosa Poncel and Ezio Pinza with the chorus of the Metropolitan Opera House singing La Vergine degli Angeli from La Forza del Destino. May the Virgin of the Angels within her mantle fold you, and all the holy angels in their keeping ever hold you.
Three Men Standing at the Met was presented by the writer Michael Cody. The actors were Daniel Reardon and a youthful Niall Carroll, who may be known to some of you as the presenter of Classical Daytime. The programme was produced by John Quinn and was first broadcast in 2001. Michael Cody died in March of this year, and the programme was one of many that he made with the producer John Quinn. And I've been talking recently to John, and we hope to be able to bring you a further tribute to the poet later in the year on the Lyric Feature. This evening we also remember the sculptor Imogen Stewart, who also died in March of this year. Here is a 2002 episode from the Invisible Thread series in which Theo Dorgan interviewed Imogen Stewart about her life and work.
Good evening and welcome to The Invisible Thread. I'm Theo Dorgan, and my guest this week is the sculptor Imogen Stewart. Imogen, you were born in Germany at perhaps not the best time to be born in Germany.
Oh, I was born in a very good time still in Berlin, and before in the 20s, the roaring 20s. I'm very proud of being born in the 20s still, because the 30s weren't so good anymore. You were right.
And your father was an art critic.
Yeah,
and a among writer. Many other things.
Mm, that's right.
So you grew up in a house where culture was as natural as breathing.
Yeah, I suppose that's true.
And then you came into your teenage years in, well, I suppose the barbaric decade, we would have to say.
Yeah. As a child, you're never quite aware of the full implications of it all. I would say that also war is really, as long as you have affection around you and you're being cherished and taken care of, none of these things matter that much.
Do you think that in retrospect, as you got older, that you began to reformulate your childhood through memory?
Well, I was always very aware that I had a lovely childhood. I would say that, always. And I think a good childhood is almost like a... it's such a fundamental thing. It gives you an awful lot of strength. You get through an awful lot of bad experiences, too.
And you had a good childhood.
Wonderful childhood.
But were you a good child?
In spite of war and everything. Yes, I was the goody-goody. I think so. Yeah, a bit goody-goody, I think.
Because it was one of the more boring tropes of the 20th century, that artists must have anguished beginnings.
Yes, well, that is not a continental thing, I think. For instance, my father was always... He never wanted to look like an artist, which he was. And I remember Mummy saying to him when his hair was too long, he said, "You look like a conductor, like a musician you look."
So did he cut his hair?
He had to get his hair cut.
Was your mother a strong woman?
She was very strong, yes, but also in the house. You see, she was a very, very good wife too. They had very much their own place. Mm-hmm. Mummy in the house and my father outside.
And would that have suited you, do you think?
Well, I mean, I was a mummy as well. I definitely was that. You see, first of all, when my children were brought up in the country, I had my studio right behind the house, workshop right behind the house, so the children could either on a rainy day they were in the studio, then you didn't have to worry about them, you didn't have to have babysitters, you left them, you hardly locked the doors. And I always had, there was no difficulty, even when we moved to Dublin, I had my studio down in the basement and the children came home from school. So it was very close and I was able to cook, do all the cooking myself. We always, at that time, you always had people to help you. Now that's one thing, that's why I was very fortunate to be a sculptor and a mother, which is now very, very difficult for women.
Would your mother have been surprised when her daughter turned out to be an artist?
Not a bit. She encouraged me. They both encouraged me and they liked it. She was terribly proud of me too. Oh, definitely.
And you were proud of them?
Oh, yes.
After the war, if I remember, your father arranged an apprenticeship for you.
That's right, yes. Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Was that still very much a feature of the German art world?
Not at all, not at all. In fact, I was so lucky. I mean, even my generation had never that sort of training, study, as the way I had it. That was a thing of the past generations. Mm-hmm. I mean, my generation was all academies and art schools. And I think I said that before. He didn't want to be called professor. I had to call him master. And that sort of laid the whole foundations of doing it very differently.
It's very medieval, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Very much so.
Guild idea.
Mm, that's right. Mm-hmm.
And do you think that's... do you think that you learn technique, but is there a danger that in that kind of system you can lose individual identity?
Well, not in... No, my man was very... I mean, my professor was very encouraging me personally, but it could be, of course. It could be very... But, I mean, art schools are like that too. They're very, very... You have to conform completely in nowadays art schools. I know of people who wanted to learn how to do a portrait. I think it was in Ireland. And this person was completely discouraged because there's nobody teaches that sort of thing anymore.
When you were 18 when you began your apprenticeship or thereabouts, was it?
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Did you find it in any way restrictive?
No, not a bit. Not a bit. Mm. You see, I mean, life in Germany was restrictive in terms of schooling and Hitler Germany. Mm. It was restrictive in any case. And then at that time, everybody lived a much more restrictive life anyway.
Your family split up during the war, didn't it? I'm just remembering. Your family split up during the war.
Well, yes, of course. I mean, most families had this sort of situation, mm-hmm. especially when they were children. So we were evacuated from Berlin, of course. But, I mean, this was an accepted fact all over Germany. Mm-hmm. And people in cities and children.
And when your family came back together again...
Yeah, that was after the war.
Yeah, I'm just thinking that you had a kind of an anomalous experience because you have family unification at a time when most people are trying to get away from their families.
Exactly, yes, that's right.
Did that have an effect on you, do you think?
To get together again?
Yes.
Oh, I mean, it's
at that crucial time in your life.
It was terrible that we were separated. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that was so wonderful that we were together again.
Because the beginning of your formal work as a sculptor coincides with the end of horrific war, reunification of your family.
Yeah, that's...
And what kind of sense of Germany did you have?
Well, I mean, I was pretty... After the war, I was pretty disgusted with everything about Germany. The only thing which I never... which I always held on to was the poetry... And the spiritual side of Germany, that meant always a lot to me because my father read us a lot of poems. That was even at the end of the war, whenever we did see him. And he would read poetry, which meant a lot to him too. He wrote also poems. And as children, he wrote ballads for us on Mummy's birthday and so on.
And would he sing them?
Yes, we sang them.
And were you a singer?
Well, just like what you learned at school. I mean, when you sing at school, always, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Your father had a hard war, hadn't he? I mean, it was very nerve-wracking.
Yes, very, very hard. Absolutely. And we didn't know anything about it, really. It was all kept very, very secret from us children, which is very important, which was very important. You have no idea how different it would have been if we would have known the full implication of his difficulties and problems with his mother and my father himself. Yeah, that's it.
You see, I'm trying to find the young Imogen who's 18, who's trying to construct a new life with a family, with a beloved father. Were you very close to your father?
Very.
Closer than to your mother?
Well, I would say so. Mummy had the hard job to be strict and discipline us and tell us how to do it and how not to do things. And I mean, she really had a much harder time, and I feel much more now sympathetic towards her. And it is much harder for a good mother.
Mm-hmm. Go back to your apprenticeship. You're learning to sculpt, mm-hmm. not to draw or paint. Or mm-hmm. why sculpture? What was that?
Well, I wanted to be a designer first. Then I had the fortune that I went to Otto Hitzberger. And starting off as, I think the first day, I still came with the idea of being a designer. He said, no, do some drawings. And I did some drawings. And then I modeled something in clay. And then about the third day or fourth day, he said, here, why don't you start doing some carving? Do some wood carving. And that's how I got stuck with that.
Where was this, by the way?
That was in Bavaria. He was retired.
That's what I thought.
He was
a
traditional
Bavarian, wasn't
he? Exactly. Well, he had the real traditional training. Then he was under Professor Bruno Paul in Berlin. That was in the very early 30s, might be even the late 20s. He was called to the Hochschule für Bildende Kunst. That's really the University of Fine Arts. Yeah, College of Fine Arts in Berlin. And they had the same idea as the Bauhaus. Mm-hmm. So he came to Berlin and not an academician, really, which made a very great difference. I mean, not an academy-trained man. He was much more, they were all back to the material, back to shape, form. And so he was asked to come to Berlin. And then it happened then that I got into the same way of being taught.
Because it's curious, it's kind of like sidestepping history in a way. I'm thinking, for instance, that in the tradition of German sculpture, the sources of patronage were the state governments or the overriding government,
yeah,
the church,
yeah,
and the bourgeoisie,
yeah,
or the municipality,
yeah,
which
yeah,
is the same
mm-hmm.
thing. And yet, I mean, the church had a fairly shameful time in some ways through the war. The state was in ruins and there was no bourgeoisie left. So you would have said that somebody setting out to be a sculptor was going to be making work in something of a vacuum.
Well, I was used to, my father always liked sculpture. He wrote a book also on sculpture. And I always, the statue, I was sort of brought up with sculpture. And I had sculptures around me, even at an early stage. And
didn't
I think
even
that
enter
probably,
your mind that you mightn't make a living from this?
And actually, I forgot to tell you something. Just shortly before the war, there was a lady, she was a well-known sculptress. And we were taught, my sister and I, we were taught doing sculptures. Little animals we did. And I still have a little dog, which I made. And I was 12.
Right.
You see, and we had to work in the basement because we weren't allowed. Mummy wouldn't have us having clay all over the place. Mm-hmm. And so I started very early. And art was always something which meant something more than the average person to me. There's no doubt about it.
It almost sounds as if there was just a sort of a slipstream running in your life and you just settled into it.
Yeah, I think so. That's right.
Now,
I think that's very well put.
Something else interesting and important happened to you when you were studying under Hitzberger.
Well, whenever the weather was good, we didn't work at all. He said, Madel, that was sort of real traditional way of saying little girl, Madel, let's go up the mountains.
Right.
And then sometimes we went drive first with his jalopy, which really it was a jalopy. The whole towns knew when the professor was driving to the... they said, the professor's arriving, you know. And it really was like this because he was, I mean, an impossible driver. And we would go up the mountains and walk up. Oh, I mean, this is an unforgettable experience which I had. And he knew, of course, a lot of people. And he brought me to wonderful places. And whenever the sunshine shone, we went up and doing that.
And wasn't it then you met Ian Stewart?
Yes. Well, that was a good while later.
Was it?
Yes, yeah. This happened also through a mutual friend. It was the former German ambassador, Eduard Hempel. He was friendly with Ian's mother.
Right.
And at that time, and she, no, he wrote. Ian wanted to become a sculptor. He was already at the art school. And in Dublin, yeah. That's right. And Edward Hempel wrote to my father. They knew each other a long time ago.
Right.
Long even before they were all married, I think. And said there's a young Irishman who would like to be trained as a sculptor and would like to do something in Germany. So my father wrote back, well, he said, my daughter also does sculpture. That's how it happened. I mean, it was so, it was sort of a, like exchange.
Right.
He came and stayed first in Germany, in my house, or in our apartment. We lived in an apartment that time in Bavaria. And then I came here to Ireland.
Well, you're skipping over a few bits here now, and then I came here to Ireland. The small matter of falling in love, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. First minute.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, the first minute.
You looked out the window, he was standing down on the street.
No, I collected him from the train. I collected him from the train. I thought it was fantastic.
I've seen photographs and never met him. He was quite good looking.
Oh, stunning.
Yeah, I'm sure he thought the same about you.
I don't know.
I'd hazard a guess, Imogen. I'd say he did think the same thing as well. Were you surprised to fall in love?
No, not a bit.
Had you been expecting to fall in love?
No, you see, I'm still not very analytical on myself. I really, people have to tell me much more things. Oh. I can say events, I can tell you impressions, but I'm very bad at analysing things.
Hmm. Right, so then you go and fall in love with the son of Isild Gonne, Maud Gonne's daughter, and Francis Stewart.
Yes, well, Francis, I never met him until long after the war. I think I met him first in Ireland. I wouldn't have met him before my mother-in-law died.
You came to Ireland?
Yeah.
In what way? Did you come as an exchange student? Or?
Yeah, well, doing sculpture now with Ian in his, where he lived in County Wicklow.
In Lara?
Yes, in a castle.
And did you?
I mean, it was called Lara Castle, but it hadn't. It was, to the outside, it looked definitely like a castle. It was castle-fied. Mm-hmm. It was originally a British Army barracks.
Right.
Which was turned into a castle.
And did you find it a very strange place?
Stunning. Fairy tale. Beautiful. Absolutely magic.
And did you speak English at that time?
I learned it at school, but I wasn't very good at it.
Because you don't have a Wicklow accent.
No, I never got the Wicklow accent, but I was always a bit shy. I was a bit afraid of people.
Definitely. I wouldn't have thought you were afraid.
I mean, I think I've changed an awful lot in the last 25 years. I'm not shy anymore. I was terribly shy, really, at parties, at everywhere. I was everywhere shy.
And you both worked together? Did you have studio together?
Yeah, well, we had so many outhouses. Mm. First we were together, yes, and then he had another big place, you know, for stables and horses, and we had a prisoner's yard even.
Hmm.
A prisoner's yard, which was used for hens. We had hens in the prisoner's yard.
What was the first piece of work you sold? Can you remember?
Yes, oh, yes.
That's a big moment in any artist's life.
You see, Ian had a wonderful way of telling me something about the Irish saints, and that's why I became a Catholic. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been a Catholic even. And I just loved to hear anything about Irish saints. St. Kevin, of course, living in Glendalough. And I carved my first carving, which I showed in the academy, was St. Brendan discovering America. Why I chose St. Brendan, I really couldn't tell you. But anyway, that was
it. This was in the early 50s, was it?
That would have been... No, that was 49 or so, yeah. I would say so, because 1950, I was in Germany. 1951, we married, and I came back here, went back and forwards. Mm. At that time, you had to go by boat, by train, through England, all that. No flying.
St. Brendan, discovering America.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of your work has been for the church.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the commissions that you've had have been from churches.
Mm-hmm.
Has that been a productive relationship for you? Or was it simply what you had to do?
No, it was. Well, first of all, I was very appreciated from the very start.
Mm-hmm.
They were the only people who gave you commissions. The church were the only people in Ireland who gave you commissions. There was, I must say, there was the Living Art. There was certain people like Nora McGuinness, Louis Lebrocky, they did work for the Living Art, or they got commissions. But even that, I would say, it would be interesting to talk to Louis about it, who commissioned him at that time. But the church was a solid mission. And I would say, why did I get the commissions is because I did religious work. The quality didn't matter so much at that stage.
Well, it was not to more them, that presumably it did to you.
To me, well, I mean, I did my own bit.
No, this what I meant, I meant by the question, was it a productive relationship? I suppose I didn't phrase it very well. Was, as you say, in the 50s and 60s in the churches, as long as it was big and made an impact, they accepted. But you had to have a different dynamic as an artist. You had to try and push your own sense of the expressiveness of the materials and so on. So yeah, could you not have... Wasn't there a danger you could have been lazy and simply and produced the work anyway? That's a sort of a pitfall for you.
Yeah, well, we need money. We were living on... We had to bring up children. And there was only one way of working for me, anyway. There may have been the odd time. I do remember getting some commissions from America. They had to be more conservative. But even that wasn't... I mean, I never had to sell myself or prostitute myself in my work. I would say I never had to do this. And the people who commissioned us, priests and so on, they were interested in somebody who does religious work. Really, the quality didn't matter. That I considered myself a good sculptor. That didn't come... That wasn't for them important. Yeah. Is that the way I... Perhaps I don't phrase it rightly.
And what did you use... What drove you to self-improvement? That's a terrible term. As an artist, what... How did you manage to keep that dynamic going with indifferent patrons? Did you do other private work?
Very little. At that time, there wasn't any more time to do anything but commissions. And I wasn't very conscious of my own importance even. I mean, it sounds all a bit funny.
No, it's just at a time when with the artist as self-proclaimed genius and as someone who wardens their own work is so much the case. Yours was a very different life.
I never... For instance, I remember Maria said the other day, she saw photographs of me. I was dressed sort of... well, she thought it looked like a schoolgirl. I never had to pronounce to anybody that I'm an artist. I never had that need.
You said somewhere once that you're very impatient with the term artist. You think that there are sculptors, there are painters, there are drawers.
Yes, exactly.
But there's no such thing as the generic thing, artist.
No, I think that word, it doesn't appeal to me very much.
Yeah, I feel the same thing about the arts.
You feel
there's
that
no
too.
Such thing as the arts. You don't rush home, change your clothes and head out again to the arts. You
exactly.
go to the theatre, to
exactly.
an exhibition.
I mean, either you have an artistic mind or you're an artistic person. But you are not, I think that comes from something quite else. There's such a thing as technique or no technique.
Do you think some of this is to do with the fact that you worked so much with architects? That, you know, you had to work in a group context very often when you were producing a piece
of work. Always did, yes, I like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because you had a craft apprenticeship.
Yes, that's right. Very much so.
And then you were dependent on external commissions.
Very much so, yeah, that's right.
So you're in a kind of a socialized context.
Yeah, true.
But was there another Imogen inside that, a slightly rebellious Imogen who wanted to do things for their own sake and for her own sake?
No, I don't think so. You see, there was very little rebelliousness in me ever. I don't think so. There wasn't that much time for me to do
When you
things.
Make a piece for yourself, what drives you? What's working there? What's at work there?
Oh, I mean, I have to do that. It's just that I have an idea. Sometimes it's a sketch. Sometimes it comes from a photograph. Sometimes it comes from an experience or something you've seen. And then you want to do something, and then I do it. And sometimes I do it small first, sometimes, and mostly, and then do cartoons. I work then very systematically organized.
Brian Fallon, who's a very perceptive and astute critic, expressed the wish some time ago that you would work more often on a small scale.
Yeah. Yes,
that's right. What did you think when he said that?
Yeah, I think he's probably right. My sister says the same thing. I should do my small things. I will. But there, at the moment, I still have this big urge. I sort of want to make a statement for the future. Perhaps it's that.
Hmm.
But I will do something small again. My sister says I should do more animals.
Do you have a sense of the future? I mean, for your work, that your work has a future?
Yes, I hope so.
Mm.
Yes, I think so. I suppose there is a little bit of a missionary thing in oneself, that these things last you out. I suppose, especially when you're doing something for over 50 years, this develops, I would say.
Because one of the things about sculpture that strikes you most immediately is its solidity in time.
Yeah.
A piece of sculpture is very solid in time.
Mm-hmm.
And yet now our experience of ourselves as beings in time is very evanescent.
Exactly.
So there's a tension between what you're doing and the time in culture that we're
But
in.
Isn't it wonderful? I mean, first of all, I think sculpture is from the, in a way, beautiful way, you're a creator, first of all, which is something very special.
Because you're working with the stuff of the world in sculpture.
I mean, think of doing something in stone, even wood lasts so long. Mm. I mean, that is something very, very beautiful.
Do you have a sense of a lineage? Do you see yourself in a line of sculptors?
Oh, yeah, that as well.
Mm-hmm. And who would be in that line?
I know a number of Italians once. I like Marini and I like Manzu. They didn't work in wood. Then very much like my professor, of course. I'm full of gratitude towards him. And then also a person like Barlach. And then the old sculptors all over Europe, really.
Because Fallon, again, I think, locates you very much in the German craft tradition.
Yes, mm-hmm.
Are you comfortable with that? Do you see yourself as an element in a chain of transmission?
Well, I'm quite happy about this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if your father were to walk into your retrospective or semi-retrospective in the RHA,
I would really love it.
Would he be happy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he would, yes. He would be very proud of me.
Mm-hmm.
He would probably say one thing he liked more than another.
Mm.
Mm,
do you speak to him when you're working? Do you mutter when you're... Are you one of these people who mutters when she's working?
No, I don't. I have music on all day long.
Yeah.
No, I think of them a lot.
Do you have a sense of the shape of your life, Imogen?
What does that mean?
I mean that it has had a trajectory.
I don't know.
That it has followed a line. Or has it been accident?
No. No, I don't think. No, not an accident at all. No, it's all going very... I hope it's going very... It's sort of a development. Well, I mean, when you think of if you're keep up working, if you're able to keep up work, there must be a development.
And you get up every day and go to work?
Well, that would be my ideal, yes.
And what keeps it going?
Oh, I always like working. I love to be out in my studio. It's just like it's like a sanctuary.
Sanctuary.
It's like a sanctuary.
Perfect word. Imogen Stewart, thank you for being with us on The Invisible Thread.
Thank you.
And that was an episode from 2002 of The Invisible Thread, a series we used to broadcast each Sunday evening at 10 o'clock. Theo Dorgan was interviewing the late Imogen Stewart, and the producer of that episode was Owen Brady. Both of this evening's programmes are available to podcast from our website and from other podcast platforms. On next week's programme, Barbara O'Hogan remembers the poet and playwright Winifred Letts, who was the second woman, after Lady Gregory, to have more than one play performed at the Abbey Theatre, and whose war poetry provides a rare woman's witness to the horrors of World War I. That's These Things I Wish on the Lyric Feature next Sunday at 6 p.m.